Good evening, everybody. It's LSE tradition in the old theatre that we start our events pretty much slap bang on time. Don't use the academic hour. But there's one LSE tradition which I'd like you to break tonight, and that is, could you please turn off your mobile phones, and please do not leave during the course of the lecture. If you're going to leave, please wait until afterwards. Thank you very much. Well, so good evening, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this event to celebrate and inaugurate Professor Sarah Franklin's chair in the social study of biomedicine, which is held in the sociology department at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And the lecture tonight will be followed by a period of questions, and then afterwards a reception in the senior common room to which you're all invited. The LSE has long had an interest in what the social sciences might learn from the biological sciences. But this chair is a new one, and it's linked to a bold new initiative in which the school seeks to understand the crucial changes in our social, economic, political, and personal life that are being brought about by developments in the life sciences and biomedicine. And there can be no one better suited to engage with this agenda than the person I'm introducing to you tonight, my dear colleague Sarah Franklin. Now, for those of us who know Sarah's work and its profound impact on sociology, on anthropology, on feminist thought, on social studies of science, and much more, it comes as a bit of a surprise to realize that her first teaching post was only in 1990, and her first full-time lectureship in the Department of Sociology at Lancaster University just over 10 years ago. After a BA in anthropology at Smith College, the largest liberal arts college for women in the United States, and MAs in women's studies from Kent and in anthropology from New York University, Sarah went on to take her doctorate at the very influential Center for Contemporary Cultural Studies, alas, no more, at Birmingham University. And it was from CCCS, as we used to know it in those days, that she produced her first influential intervention into feminism and cultural studies, a powerful anthology called Off Center, published in 1991 and co-edited with Jackie Stacey and my own former colleague, now head of sociology at Goldsmiths, Celia Lurie. This was just the first of a series of interventions into feminism across the 1990s, many of them co-written with the same authors. And indeed, I've chosen this to illustrate one of Sarah's great strengths, her loyalty, her consistency, her willingness to commit her time and her energies to building lasting intellectual connections, rather rare in the academic world of today. Not only has she co-edited Global Nature, Global Culture, published in 2000 with Celia and Jackie, the same co-editors, but that 1991 collection is to be republished in a second edition in 2006. And for those of us who know the fate of many anthologies in the social sciences, to be republished again 15 years later says something about the durability and scholarship of that collection. Her doctoral thesis from Birmingham was published in 1992 as Contested Conceptions, a Cultural Account of Assisted Reproduction. And this was followed by a series of profound and insightful studies of contemporary transformations of reproduction, each grounded in scrupulous and rigorous empirical research, and each conceptually groundbreaking. Procreation Stories, Visual Culture and Reproductive Politics, which was co-edited with Maureen McNeil, I see here tonight. Technologies of Procreation, a Study of Kinship in the Age of Assisted Conception, co-edited with Jeanette Edwards, which presented the results of the first major anthropological study of new reproductive technologies in Britain. Embodied Progress, published in 1997, which linked ethnography with a study of public cultural representations of changing technologies of reproduction. Now, I could go on with this list, and indeed, in addition to some 14 books and edited collections, Sarah has published a whole host of scholarly papers, reports, and chapters in books. I counted about 50 book chapters and journal articles, not least a piece in the Encyclopedia of Bioethics in 1995 on the meaning of life. Sarah's engagement with the social impact of the life sciences and reproductive technologies was prescient and has made her a leader in a field that has now become very crowded. Her long view is welcome in an area where breathless speculation abounds. It's her combination of rigor and engagement, her willingness to tackle the crucial questions and to do so without hype and in a way that's grounded in the reality of the lives of those, especially of those women who experience and live them. It's this that makes Sarah a special kind of scholar. And her work rate shows no sign of slackening. Born and Made, her study of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, co-authored with Celia Roberts, will be published by Princeton in 2006, and her path-breaking multi-sited ethnography of the story of Dolly, the first cloned sheep, the first cloned animal, will be published by Duke in the same year under the title Dolly Mixtures. I've restrained myself tonight, and I'm going to leave all the sheep jokes to Sarah. Now, there's a regrettable tendency in my discipline for there to be an inverse relationship between productivity and scholarship. Many of the most well-known sociologists of our day produce epochal accounts of our changing times that are, if not exactly evidence-free, are at least evidence-light. Sarah is not one of those. Her arguments are more enlightening and her productivity so more remarkable because each study is rooted in the changing realities of our contemporary form of life, in the changing character of life itself. Now, I don't want to take up any more of your time, but just before handing over to Sarah, I want to pay tribute to one other aspect of her. That is her role as a colleague and a teacher. Those who've worked with Sarah in the past, her colleagues at Lancaster, will echo me when I say that one could not hope for a better colleague. Since coming to the LSE, Sarah has worked tirelessly for the development of the sociology department and for our BIOS Center, where she directs our graduate program and where she is associate director. She runs this program, has pioneered an immensely successful new master's on these issues, and is a most inspiring teacher whose commitment to her students is unrivaled. When she came to the LSE, she said she had some concern about whether she was an LSE kind of person. Well, I think Sarah embodies above all the ethos of the intellectual that LSE stands for: engaged, collegial, committed, passionate yet scholarly, dedicated to the sharing and communication of knowledge and to the engagement of that knowledge with the problems that confront us in our world today. It's for these reasons, among many more, that I'm delighted to invite her to inaugurate her professorship with this lecture entitled The Reproductive Revolution: How Far Have We Come? Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Sarah Franklin.
Oh, well, I'm tired just listening. Thank you for that lovely introduction, Nicholas, and good evening. Welcome, and thank you for joining me this evening. Happy Thanksgiving. And can I just say, I'm indebted to more people here tonight than I can possibly name, and just looking out and seeing so many of you is a very lovely sight. So, my title is meant to be provocative by using an attention-seeking term, revolution, and its marching companion, how far have we come, to establish a question in the form of a familiar cliché. In doing this, I hope to suggest that in order to understand what is happening in the context of new reproductive technologies, we need to look at both the content and the form, or what Hayden White famously called the content of the form. My title question thus poses another question, which is, what language we use to describe the sociology of increasing technological control over reproductive biology? While this question is of a general and intrinsic sociological interest, I also want to pose another, more specific version of this question in the form of the challenges that arise as assisted conception has come into closer connection with human embryonic stem cell research. It is this increasing proximity which poses the most recent in a series of challenges to the governance of human fertilization and embryology, which was not so long ago described as a legal vacuum, but today is increasingly visible as a primary domain of global politics. I'm particularly pleased to be able to give this lecture here at the LSE, since, as I mentioned earlier, at the centenary of the Department of Sociology, it was here at the LSE 100 years ago that one of the most important sociological arguments about reproduction took place between Edward Westermarck and his student Bronislaw Malinowski. In opposition to the views of Westermarck and many other formative theorists of kinship in the family, Malinowski argued that there was nothing inherent in the biological facts of sexual reproduction that determined their social shape. Three of Malinowski's most famous contributions to social anthropology were formulated here at the LSE in his doctoral dissertation on the family in non-Western society. He claimed first that there was, in his words, no place for a physiological fact per se in social science. Second, that even our most objective scientific claims about conception reveal an underlying social order. And third, that to paraphrase a refrain of much of his later work, what a culture believes about conception will tell you what it believes about everything else. Malinowski's argument that human biology is socially formed would be hard to refute in today's context of the redesign and reprogramming of cellular interiority on what are frequently described as the new frontiers of reproductive and genetic technology. Beyond the hype and the glamour and the razzmatazz of the new, brave new biology, however, are the social mechanisms that bring about this change, and it is these that require more precise description. When I Googled reproductive revolution, I got more than 1.5 million results in less than half a second, which is the product of yet another technological revolution and a reminder that the language of revolution is increasingly today used to describe technology rather than social movements. I suggest we need to think about the reproductive revolution the other way around, from the point of view of the social actors involved. Revolution is a useful term because, of course, it means many things. Among the four definitions of revolution in the American Heritage Dictionary, which you'll pardon me for using on this occasion, but it is Thanksgiving, is a sudden or momentous change in a situation. This is one way to describe what happened in 1978 when it suddenly became a clinically viable possibility to create what was initially described as a test tube baby. Public response to the birth of Louise Brown in Oldham, Lancashire in the summer of 1978 was mixed. While many people could empathize with Mr. and Mrs. Brown on the occasion of their daughter's birth, the very term test tube baby conjured up an all too familiar set of less joyful connotations. At once a moment of triumph for British medical science, and another world first to add to a long list of accomplishments in the life sciences, fears were also expressed that the baby of the century might be a slippery slope that would bring Britain into disrepute. But how radical was revolution? How radical was in vitro fertilization, or IVF? The UK has been home to a vital curiosity about the facts of life that extends from the 18th century experiments of livestock breeding by agricultural entrepreneurs such as Robert Bakewell, to fascination with the genetic code that characterized the post-war period. So in some senses, it could be argued that IVF is nothing new. The primary definition of revolution is orbital motion, rotational motion around an axis, or a single complete cycle of such motion. Perhaps this is a better way to describe in vitro fertilization, as it was, in many senses, as much a return as a sudden or momentous change. Much of the scientific knowledge on which IVF depends dates back centuries to the long history of debate about the biological workings of conception and development. Were we to consider the embryo to be the point around which orbital scientific motion or attention has been focused, we could go back to Aristotle and beyond. Robert Edwards, who was one of the co-developers of IVF, along with the obstetrician Patrick Stepchow, first wrote about IVF in his PhD in the 1950s in Edinburgh, where he studied under Waddington. Prior to his work in humans, Edwards experimented with the eggs and embryos of mice, rats, hamsters, sheep, cows, and primates. The human oocyte proved, unexpectedly, and like that of pigs, to require more than 24 hours to mature in vivo, and it was in 1965 when Edwards first described the tentative steps towards IVF in the British journal Nature. What was radical about IVF was the transfer of these experimental and essentially agricultural techniques into clinical practice. In the face of considerable skepticism and even outright professional hostility, Steptoe and Edwards began transferring fertilized oocytes back into women patient volunteers in 1972. As we now know, Louise Brown was born 6 years later. It is often forgotten that the first major field of scholarly literature on the social implications of new reproductive and genetic technologies was produced by feminist scholars during the 1980s. I cited over 100 such studies in my PhD. The first ethnography of a reproductive technology, amniocentesis, was by Barbara Katz Rothman in her brilliant analysis of what she called the tentative pregnancy, published in 1986, in which she documented how women's experience of pregnancy was rendered ambivalent by the knowledge that they might have to terminate their pregnancy depending on the test result. Anne Oakley's work on the medicalization of childbirth and on ultrasound here in the UK was complemented by Emily Martin's brilliant analysis of technology, reproduction, and embodiment in The Woman in the Body, published by Beacon Press in Boston in 1987. A key feature of these studies and many others captured by the feminist biologist and theorist Donna Haraway was the double-edged quality of new technologies, which enabled some choices at the expense of others. As she put it in her famous Cyborg Manifesto, quote, "The structural rearrangements related to the social relations of science and technology evoke a strong ambivalence." As feminists predicted, this ambivalence has proven to be one of the core sociological themes of both the reproductive revolution and the wider biosociety of which it is a part. The other major area of work on reproduction in the 1970s and the 1980s came from feminist anthropology, by scholars such as Annette Wiener, who argued that for too long, reproduction has been viewed in its biological context only. Revisiting Malinowski's theme, and also the site of his fieldwork in the Trobriand Islands, Wiener wrote in 1978, "I analyze reproduction not as a biological construct, but as a cultural concept in which the basic process for reproducing human beings, social relations, cosmological phenomena, and material resources are culturally defined and structurally interconnected." This view led to a major resurgence of interest in reproduction as something that was never purely physiological or even primarily biological, but rather was at the core of social and cultural systems and always intertwined with other forms of reproduction of identities, environments, institutions, and social structures. This view was significantly extended by Marilyn Strathern, who argued simultaneously in two path-breaking publications, How Marilyn, in 1992, that it was technological assistance to reproduction that made its hybridity, its dual identity, as both social and biological, newly explicit, and that in doing so created new ambiguities about the meaning of biological facts. "There is a new ambiguity about what should count as natural," she noted, claiming also that technological assistance to human reproduction would have effects on cultural knowledge. The more facilitation is given to biological reproduction of human persons, the harder it is to think of a domain of natural facts independent of social intervention. This, Strathern argued, will not be without consequence for the way people think about one another. Nor, it has turned out, without consequence for the way people think about sheep. For what is the main question that has been asked about Dolly the sheep since she became the first viable offspring to be cloned from an adult cell it is whether humans can be cloned. And why is this? Because we assume that what can be done to the reproductive biology of sheep can be done to the reproductive biology of humans. Intervention into the reproduction of sheep, thus, it appears, has ontological consequences for who we think we are. Perhaps we need some help from Dolly. We wouldn't have to wait too long. So perhaps we should think a bit about her technologically conceived body with its unusual electrical origins and ironically unique individual pedigree as a clone. It is oddly telling that the most revolutionary thing about Dolly's body is that she looks just like a perfectly normal sheep. It is a paradox of our times that what was miraculous about this sheep was that there was nothing unusual about her. Her viability as an offspring provided biological proof of the viability of the scientific technique used to create her. To further prove her complete viability, Dolly was conventionally bred, meaning to a ram, and gave birth to two sets of lambs, confirming her fertility through a kind of double reproductive or reverse reproductive grammar of biological normality. And this is a very important part of the new biology, that it has not so much left the older, more conventional biology behind, but has added to it. And I've given Dolly a little animation here, you know, just to kind of bring her in. So, Dolly, a perfectly normal sheep. When we see a picture of Dolly, what we are very often shown in quick succession or beside her is one of the emergent iconic images of the reproductive revolution. As Jackie Stacey notes, the cell is the iconic signifier of life itself at its most bodily level. This new iconic primal image, the looking down the microscope view of micromanipulation, is also a new scene of life's recreation, typically set as a horizon, the egg cell or embryo, a kind of floating planetary orb, and the pipettes on either side forming a new plane of interaction with the interior of the cell. This is an important birth scene for the new horizon industries of stem cell science, in the context of which the interior of the cell has become a new frontier of exploration. What is different about this new image of scientific exploration, unlike the delicate fetal portraits of Leonard Nilsen's Journey Inside the Womb, or the images of the Blue Planet taken by astronauts from outer space, which are two of the most iconic images of life itself from the previous century, is the prominence of the tools of the trade, or the hands of science, in this new visual iconography of life itself being remade. This is an intimate portrait of the biotechnological interface that challenges us today, in an image of explicit interaction, revealing a new degree of biological mobility and contingency, literally breaking the frame. This is how the inextricability of social and biological form can now be delivered on the evening news. But let's go back a bit to an earlier period in the reproductive revolution. What is interesting about the radical nature of IVF when it was first practiced is how quickly this technique has been normalized. Since 1978, more than 2 million IVF babies have been born worldwide, and in some countries, such as Denmark, IVF births make up as much as 5% of the birth rate. IVF has become a platform technology for an ever-widening range of applications, from pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, aneuploidy screening, sex selection, and male infertility, among others. Ironically, it is the widespread availability of IVF that has itself now come to pose a new reproductive risk from the point of view of obstetricians who fear its very existence results in too much reliance on the last chance it offers to the over 35s who face a higher risk of reproductive complication. We might thus think of IVF in yet another sense of revolution, meaning the overthrow of one government and its replacement by another. From the hopelessness which once prevailed in the context of infertility, in which there was little medical prospect of repair, we have moved into the new era of reproductive intervention and management, in which, since 1978, it is clear that more and more can now be done to assist conception. Rather than being a hopeless condition, infertility is now subject to a new order, in which conception is something that can be achieved. This new order of conception, as it has become more technological, is manifest in a number of related changes that have flowed directly from IVF. From being a personal, private, and often secretive topic, reproductive failure has become much more of an explicit public concern. Reproductive assistance has become the subject of lobbying groups and campaigns, leading to the birth of what some have called reproductive citizenship. IVF is part of a competitive, commercial, and increasingly global market in reproductive services and products, leading some couples to travel to other countries to seek out specific services or cheaper prices in what is now known as reproductive tourism. From being a comparatively inaccessible process, conception has literally moved out of the womb and into full view, with many implications for how we view the human embryo, which is now even featured in beer commercials and on the most recent advertisement for Nokia phones. In fact, recently here in London, I was walking down the street the day the Newcastle team announced their new mitochondria replacement program, and the headline of the Evening Standard said in huge type, "Scientists create amazing embryo." I photographed it with my mobile phone, thus collapsing two reproductive revolutions into one. Unfortunately, I haven't learned how to download it yet, so I had to put a different slide in my PowerPoint. Reproduction has also become subject to an explicit form of governance through legislation such as the UK's famous Human Fertilization and Embryology Act, the world's most comprehensive regulation in this area, which came into force in 1990. The fact that the human embryo has acquired such a complicated social, economic, and political life, and that reproduction can now be considered a technological achievement, are but a few of the many radical changes that have occurred since 1978. And yet these changes are rarely represented as revolutionary and have instead, in many respects, become routine. IVF, which is by far the most prominent form of reproductive intervention to have been established in the past two decades, is now a familiar part of modern life and is represented in terms of some of the oldest and most traditional social aspirations and hopes, namely the desire to have children, to improve technology, to encourage scientific progress, and to alleviate human suffering. So I want to turn now to one of the most important senses of revolution, which is its use to signify progress. And the slide here is showing the Hashmi family, which, as some of you may know, have a son, Zane, who suffers from genetic disease, for whom they've been trying to conceive a sibling who could be a donor of cord blood, which could potentially cure this otherwise possibly terminal condition. And this is a very good example, this case, of the way in which progress is embedded in very, very conventional aspirations and hopes. So in contrast to the association of the designer baby with technology, really what I'm arguing here is that many of the drivers of this area are far from radically revolutionary new technologies. They're really actually quite familiar kinds of parental desires. So this sense of revolution to signify progress is the one that's used to refer, for example, to the Industrial Revolution, the Scientific Revolution, or the revolutionary consequences of the Internet. The adjective revolutionary signifies progress, improvement, and subsequent transformation, and is routinely annexed to science and technology to convey a sense of moving forward into a new era in which the old ways of the past are cast aside. From this perspective, the reproductive revolution is viewed as a breakthrough in the capacity of medical science to overcome previously unassailable obstacles and the opening up of whole new possibilities that were formerly all but unimaginable. Significantly, this notion of revolution as progress, as scientific progress, although today primarily associated with technology, has its roots, as Maureen McNeil has shown, in ideas about biology, and even more particularly about reproduction. As McNeil notes, the idea that the biological function of reproduction is integral to the project of human advancement, and indeed that human biology could itself be a model of progress and improvement, was first formulated by Erasmus Darwin in the middle of an earlier period of revolutionary technological change in England during the late 18th century. His grandson Charles Darwin's theories of evolution are arguably where the idea of progress first became attached to reproduction by analogy to industrial technology. So, is today's reproductive revolution revolutionary or not? The question we have to ask about the curious case of the reproductive revolution, which both is and is not new, both is and is not biological, and may or may not be radically transformative of who we are, is what kind of revolution is it? Is it a revolution in progress? And if so, what kind of progress is the result? Zygmunt Bauman, who recently completed 3 lectures here at the LSE, has argued that the novelty of our times is that periods of condensed and accelerated change called revolutions are no longer breaks in the routine like they might have seemed in the past. He argues instead that we live today that we live today under a condition of permanent revolution. Revolution is the way society nowadays lives. Revolution has become human society's normal state. Interestingly, Bauman's contemporary, Ulrich Beck, argues that the opposite has happened to the idea of progress. Once a defining feature of revolutionary change, scientific and technological progress can no longer be thought of in the singular, but must be imagined as always already accompanied by its double in the form of increased risk. Hence, while scientific progress may be associated with the revolutionary developments enabling the emergence of modernity, it is in turn this very same form of progress and its discontents that brings us the counterface of modernity in the form of the risk society, in which, as Beck puts it, the sources of danger are no longer ignorance, but knowledge. So how might we think of the reproductive revolution in relation to these arguments by 2 of Europe's leading social scientists who, it might be added, appear to have returned to some of the major themes of an earlier feminist discussion of these questions? Is IVF an example of the kind of revolutionary change we've come to take for granted? Is human reproduction a good place to look for the kind of permanent revolution that has become a normal state? What about progress? Is the revolutionary impact of new reproductive technologies an example of the impossibility of imagining progress without risk? Are the new reproductive choices being made by would-be IVF parents typical examples of reflexive, risk-calculating, self-actualizing decision-making in the postmodern context of increased skepticism about expert knowledge, ambivalence, uncertainty, and doubt? Perhaps. But if we listen to what people say when they're in the midst of undergoing treatments such as, IVF or PGD, they do not always express themselves in exactly these terms. For example, one of the most striking findings of the very first study I did of IVF in the late 1980s and early 1990s was that in every single interview, people said they felt they had to try IVF and that they had no choice but to pursue this technique. In other studies I have undertaken since, these and similar expressions of obligation, duty, and of not having any choice are one of the most consistent themes. These motivations, not technology, are the sociological roots of the reproductive revolution, whatever kind of revolution it may be. So how do we interpret a situation in which people choosing IVF describe themselves as having to try and having no choice? Is this a technological imperative that emerges out of the same dynamic that constantly associates new technology with progress and revolutions? If so, what is this dynamic composed of? What is its sociology, and how can this be characterized? The question posed by the reproductive revolution is not only what kind of revolution it might be, but how we measure the change this supposedly describes in terms of how far we have come. So let us consider this question in terms of where we are now. In addition to being in the old theater at the LSE, we are in the UK, which is currently one of the most radical countries in Europe in terms of its position on stem cell research, which is a science that has come of age almost entirely as a result of the enormous expansion in the use of IVF, creating the supply of human embryos now available for scientific research. We also need to remember that in addition to being the country in which IVF was first developed, the UK is where much of the modern embryology and developmental biology on which assisted conception depends was also developed. Both IVF and Dolly are the offspring of a scientific community that has been reverse engineering biological development for centuries. Post-IVF, new understandings of cellular differentiation, and more recently via Dolly, de-differentiation, have been driven in no small part by an emergent and more collectivized form of reproductive hope directed at finding cures for disease by harnessing the special reproductive power of embryonic cells. It is this special or totipotent regenerative capacity of the embryo that has been linked to the prospect of new treatments for everything from Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease to diabetes and cancer. So, where we are today is, once again, at a new, and some will say, revolutionary interface between the now routine existence of IVF and the not-so-routine existence of something else: human embryonic stem cell research, the science of creating new medical therapies out of embryos that have been created through IVF. To explain a little further, if you are a woman undergoing IVF, you are 80% likely to fail, and to maximize your chances of success, you undergo a hormonal replacement program to stimulate egg development, which is known as ovulation induction. This means that you're hormonally stimulated to produce more eggs, ideally 10 or 12. These eggs are fertilized in vitro, and the more viable embryos you end up with, the more you have to attempt successful embryo transfer when the fertilized eggs are put back into your womb. But only two can be put back in at a time in order to minimize the chances of multiple pregnancy, which often leads to complications. The rest of the embryos, if they appear to be developing normally, are most often frozen for future use. Many couples consequently have what are described as excess, surplus, or spare embryos at the end of their treatment, and they may choose to donate some or all of these to other couples or to research. They can also do neither and simply allow the embryos to perish after 5 or exceptionally 10 years, which is the legal limit on embryo storage. In a recent study I conducted with my colleagues Karen Throsby and Celia Roberts of couples' willingness to donate embryos to stem cell research, 67.95% wanted to pursue this option. And this is not surprising, as it is difficult, time-consuming, and emotionally fraught to go through IVF, and the desire for leftover embryos that are not going to be used in treatment to be valued in another context, such as scientific research, is often described in terms of wanting to give something back. However, this situation is not uncomplicated. In addition to other risks, such as the risk to health, which is minimal but present for women who undergo ovulation induction, there is a new risk of conflict of interest between stem cell science and IVF that women or couples in the context of assisted conception are vulnerable to pressure to donate their leftover embryos to the new reproductive revolution that is stem cell science. Is this an example of the unsettling consequences of revolutions for their citizens who may be subjected to new forms of exploitation? Or is egg donation potentially a new way to become a biological volunteer for scientific progress? Given the tendency for femininity to be organized in relation to serving the needs of others, is this a particularly worrying trend? And given the persistent economic inequality, which defines the sexual division of labor globally, is a new division of reproductive labor not likely to follow a similar path? So this brings us to the important question we might describe not so much in terms of the revolution as progress or a revolution in progress, but the progress of revolutions, as in their succession. For we should not be surprised that the reproductive revolution has also been reproductive of itself. As IVF and stem cells demonstrate, one revolution can give birth to another. But how do we evaluate the new contingency and proximity between IVF and stem cell research? I've already suggested it's useful to ask some of the people directly involved. So here are a few quotations from people whom we might describe as reproductive citizens who have been asked to donate their embryos to stem cell research. Some respondents expressed the classically reciprocal gift model famous from the work of Richard Titmuss here at the LSE on blood donation of giving something back. We would not have the opportunity to benefit from IVF if other people had not been there first, and we feel we'd like to give back what we can with our embryos to help. Other respondents were more equivocal. So much depends on what they would be used for and how long they would be stored. I'm not always confident that research is being done for the right reasons rather than simply because it's advancing medical science. And some respondents said no. Having lost two babies, I feel that I could not use the beginnings of another for research. As we can see, some respondents express a desire to contribute their embryos to a new, more generalized context of reproductive hope, meaning the hope for new cures from scientific advances in the ability to harness the special reproductive qualities of embryonic cells. Other couples are less willing to convert their attachments to their embryos into faith in scientific progress, and still others could not separate their embryos from a history of reproductive loss. Even such brief quotations, I suggest, provide a crucial glimpse into the sociology of biological and technological change that may be obscured by the more triumphalist version of the reproductive revolution. For here we have, at the IVF stem cell interface, a huge question. It is the same question Malinowski asked about the place of biology in determining social structure. Only now it is reversed. For what we are now asking is how society is going to organize its own biology. And what we see are not only many answers, but even answers that are themselves made up of mixed emotions, ambivalent tendencies, and equivocation. For example, as yet another respondent replied, if people hadn't already done this IVF, we may not be able to benefit from treatment, but the embryo is the start of a living thing, and that makes it a difficult decision. Such comments require us to listen to the content as well as the form of language being used at the IVF stem cell interface in terms of what exactly is it telling us. Example here of a yes-no kind of answer expresses an ambivalence that will not be easy to capture in large-scale public opinion surveys, as its mixed message makes it very difficult to quantify. According to Ann Kerr and Sarah Cunningham Burley, two of the sociologists who've done the most work on public opinions about new genetic technology, public ambivalence towards the new biomedical revolution could open up new avenues for dialogue and deliberation, thus paving the way towards more socially responsible and democratic science and technology. However, they note that doubts and uncertainties about reproductive and genetic and biological futures associated with their various revolutionary potentials are often offset by normative and conventional assumptions about the benefits of scientific progress. As evidence of this tendency, they cite Ulrich Beck, who argues that, quote, reproductive medicine and genetic research throw open the door to a new quality of politics. Here, everyone rules himself and his progeny and can directly implement the values that govern him. Kerr and Cunningham Burley reject Beck's overvaluation of choice exercised by himself on behalf of his progeny. And as in the description of no choice offered earlier by IVF patients, they describe an ambivalent public within the new constituency Carlos Novus and Nicholas Rose describe as biological citizens, who, according to Kerr and Cunningham Burley, may hold up scientific knowledge as an accurate reflection of the workings of the human body, yet also critically discuss the methods and institutional relations of science, thus directly challenging the dominant view of scientific practice as morally and politically neutral. Like Beck, Giddens, and Bauman, Kerr and Cunningham Burley argue that a new politics of lay ambivalence may enable what Beck called the creeping revolution in democracy that will result in new forms and forms of consensus. They conclude, however, that Beck's imagined democratic creep is currently more sedative than revolutionary, implying, as others have done, that the language of revolution associated with political change has been fundamentally detached from the meaning of revolutionary used to describe technological innovation. This view, in turn, is challenged by a group of U.S. anthropologists, including Faye Ginsburg, Raina Rapp, Karen Sutosig, and Deborah Heath, who use the slightly different term, genetic citizenship, to describe new constellations of actors, such as patient groups, disability activists, and medical scientific experts, who collectively lobby and campaign for improved treatments for genetic diseases while also challenging the stigma of inherited conditions. These more politicized and revolutionary biological citizens, they argue, are evidence of new forms of socio-political activism that are reshaping what Rapp and her colleagues describe as the biogenetic public sphere. So, are the new biological citizens of the post-IVF moral landscape, to use Lena Koch's felicitous formulation? Are they ambivalent revolutionaries? Are they revolutionary ambivalents? Using IVF as an example, we could say it has brought undoubted benefits to those couples it has enabled to conceive a child, but for every one of these, there are at least four unsuccessful couples who may feel they are even more worse off after trying IVF than they were beforehand. IVF has led to complications. The sharp rise in multiple births and attendant pathology was an expensive cost to impose from the largely private assisted conception market of the 1980s and the 1990s into the already overburdened National Health Service. There is debate now about whether the more recent recommendation by the National Institute of Clinical Excellence that all couples should be entitled to 3 free IVF cycles will similarly impose an inappropriate strain on overstretched public health facilities. However, these risks are accompanied by a rapid proliferation of IVF-based therapies, including pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, aneuploidy screening, and more recently, as we have seen, the possibility of having a child who is tissue matched to become a donor to an older brother or sister who is suffering from a potentially terminal illness, the so-called save your sibling technique. This list of IVF platform technologies is now quite long, and is now complemented by stem cell research, which is among the world's most rapidly developing areas of scientific growth, into which considerable sums are being invested not only in the UK and the EU, but India, China, Japan, Canada, Australia, Singapore, and South Korea. Thus, in contrast to the use of revolutionary as a promotional adjective, this is just a map of countries that have sort of more or less permissive attitudes towards stem cell research. In contrast to the use of revolutionary as a promotional adjective to describe scientific progress in terms of advances, benefits, and improvements, it might be said this term is increasingly associated with divided opinion, mixed feelings, and professional as well as lay ambivalence, especially in the context of reproduction, where terms such as cloning carry a strong negative connotation. As Susie Leather, who is head of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, said last week at a conference on putting stem cells into practice, there are too many areas of scientific progress that have suffered as a result of negative public perceptions. The benefits of the existing system can only be maintained by strengthening public consensus. The benefits of the existing system to which she refers are those that have been established through the highly regulated and very strict licensing system for assisted conception and embryo research, which is unique to the UK and is seen to protect and promote its highly permissive climate of scientific innovation while retaining public, parliamentary, and political support to produce a climate of that is often described as well-governed scientific progress. As the journalist Carrie Kappel put it in the introduction to an article entitled In Stem Cell Research, It's Rule Britannia in Business Week in 2002, Britain, home to the world's first test tube baby and Dolly the cloned sheep, more than a decade of ongoing dialogue between scientists, government, and religious officials has resulted in the most conducive climate in the world for this important new area of scientific research. He added, Britain has long been known for Shakespeare, soccer, fine cheeses, and quirky cars. Now it's emerging as the world leader in one of the most controversial yet promising areas of stem cell research, human embryonic stem cells. He continued, Britain is the only country on the globe with a regulatory structure in place that provides a clear roadmap for both public and private sector research on human embryonic stem cells. However, as both Susie Leather and Mary Warnock, author of the report on which the legislation is based, have emphasized, scientific progress in the field of human reproduction and embryology primarily relies on what the HFEA refers to as keeping in step with public opinion. The first premise of Warnock's approach was to take very seriously the wide diversity in moral feelings and determine which feelings were most strongly held in common. The Warnock position, as sociologist Michael Mulcahy has argued, was the outcome of an effort to acknowledge fundamentally opposing views and to find the path of greatest social consensus among them. This not only remains the core strategy of the HFEA, but is widely seen by outside commentators to be the secret of the UK's success in the highly emotive, contested, and divided context of human stem cell derivation. So, in a properly revolutionary way, that is, by coming full circle, we thus reach our conclusions. It is from where we are today, here, in the UK, at the IVF stem cell interface, in 2005, in the midst of a unique global controversy about the future of human biology, that we can see a 100-year-old debate about the extent to which biology determines social structure, completing an orbital turn and returning, but also being overthrown and suddenly transformed. To the extent that scientific progress in the UK is seen to depend on keeping in step with the wider society, its future is essentially sociological. None of the future biologies that beckon as revolutionary scientific advances will become facts of life without a viable social infrastructure as their enabling condition. This does not have to be new to be revolutionary, and it does not have to be revolutionary to be important, but it does mean that Malinowski's refrain has yet to leave the building. It also means that insofar as reproduction has been revolutionized, and however we take this to be the case, its future is sociological. An example of this is the question of how the legacy of IVF will be interpreted in the context of stem cell research, not only by columnists and political commentators, but by people who are literally in the midst of the IVF stem cell interface, whose decisions about donation exemplify the difficulties of the concept of biological citizenship being debated within social science. Another measure of this will be our ability to learn from the history of IVF in a way that will change the quality of deliberation over stem cells. The nature of this deliberation depends on our language, on the ability to communicate, and this is something clinicians in particular know well. The measure of how far we have come in the reproductive revolution is also sociological. It will depend on the answers to questions such as why ambivalence is such a prominent feature of public and professional views of developments in reproductive biomedicine, and also to understand what this ambivalence is saying. The answer to this question will involve listening to ambivalence as a social form as well as a literal content. Answering this question is thus primarily an empirical task of collecting language, sorting it through, and developing an interpretation. As a description of the social study of biomedicine, I think that's quite appropriate. Thank you.
To thank Sarah for a very stimulating and wide-ranging lecture that just shows how remarkable and unique her contribution to this field is, because I think she shows us that some of the questions that appear new are actually very deep-rooted. Some of the transformations that we think of as so radical when they're looked at from a long way away in the lives of the human beings that are experiencing them look very different. Now, Sarah has indicated to me that she's happy to have 15 or 20 minutes of questions and discussion. So if you'd like to show your hands in the normal way, and I'll try and take the questions in small groups and let Sarah answer them. So comments or questions, please. There are some mics, so if you just show your hand, one there to start with.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you very much indeed for that wonderful lecture. You started off mentioning the impact of feminist scholarship. Obviously, your own work continues that feminist scholarship. You also talked about reproductive technology marking, if you like, a new kind of order, a new form of governmentality. I wonder if you'd like to say anything about how, in a very anti-feminist climate, some of this reproductive technology that you've been discussing might resonate back onto feminism, or perhaps even take some vengeance on feminism. Wow.
Okay, that seems a big enough question on its own. Let's
Is it
try
on?
That one on its own.
I think Is it on? Is my reproductive technology working?
Yep.
Okay. Well, I'm not quite sure where the agency in that question is coming and going exactly.
I guess what you mean is the way, maybe a version of what you mean is the way feminists wanted women to have more power and more choice. Now they have more reproductive choice than they ever imagined. So there, or something like that. Or are you asking?
Well, I'll just add one more sentence. Is there a way in which?
Can you get the mic?
Is there a way in which this new order actually reinscribes certain kinds of norms of family and kinship on the back of offering women great degrees of choice?
Okay, thank you very much for that question. Now I think I understand exactly what you mean. Okay, well, I think I wanted to emphasize that however kind of radically new some of the biological techniques associated, say, with stem cells are, they still depend very much on their annexation to quite familiar forms of biology. So it's really not so much a leaving behind. I think that's absolutely true of the potentially transformative nature of reproductive technology in terms, for example, of widening reproductive choice, because what we constantly see is a reinscription of the discourse of biological choice into very, very traditional kinds of idioms. And again, I think there maybe was a point in the feminist discussion of this that made it easier, because you could just point to how profoundly heteronormative the IVF discourse was. And, you know, there you are. I think what's happened is that, again, the mixed picture this presents requires a different form of analysis. And I think that's really what's very challenging, because there's no doubt that there's what you might call a knock-on effect of conception being achieved at the level of the whole idea of the family being achieved. And there are new achieved families, lesbian and gay families, adoptive families, etc., who come into a different kind of visibility alongside alternative, you might say, biological arrangements. On the other hand, that is often accompanied by a very traditional familialism that sort of goes the other way, as it were. And again, this is why I think it's a bit difficult to use, even though there is such a huge feminist literature, and rereading it, interestingly, it is itself very mixed. It's often associated with opposition, but it isn't really. It's got so many in it. This is why I say we really need to have a new set of terms and concepts to come at this. And I think ambivalence comes up so much in the literature, you've got to ask, what is it doing exactly? Yeah, I hope that's helpful.
Yeah. Okay, there's another one.
Thank you, Sarah. That was characteristically elegant. You raised the figure via Ann Kerr of a socially responsible science, which sounds a rather complicated thing in this age of ambivalence. One thing it might be is a science that's reflexively aware of its own sociality, which would be not an easy thing. But is there more to it than that? If society is so ambivalent about what it or groups within it want?
I don't think we know what the full range, or maybe even a small range, of deliberative fora in which, you know, a different kind of participation might occur vis-a-vis something like the future of stem cell research in Britain. I think Ann Kerr and Sarah Gunningham Burley have been amongst the most active and creative people investigating that whole process of what they would see as increasing participation in decision making about what kind of scientific and technological futures are possible, desirable, etc. And a number of other people have done that too. And you know, another feature of the moment is we do have, you know, a new consultation exercise on some aspect of the biosociety every week. And they're limited in many respects. It's easy to kind of say, oh, well, yeah, another kind of superficial exercise in trying to collect a range of diverse opinions so that you can be seen to have done so, almost regardless of what they say. But, I mean, I think we know that there are some consultation exercises that work much better than others. There is an increasing vocabulary in that area I would say. I don't think it's necessarily commensurate to what you might see as the scale of the kinds of questions that need to be asked, but I do think that the intimacy of the nature of biological change that is occurring, say, at the level of the human embryo is forcing an engagement with these issues that wasn't occurring quite so much when they were less intimate, because they've become very intimate, very public, and very political, kind of all at once, which is the thing I think makes it very interesting to watch, you know.
Could I perhaps put a version of that question in a slightly more controversial way? You quoted Susie Leather talking about the importance of the British model of governance of these issues and the importance of consensus. And yet you started with a quote from Donna Haraway about the endemic ambivalence that there is about all these technologies.
Yeah.
So I suppose the sharpest way of putting this would be to say, well, is the British model of consensus, which has enabled bioeconomic progress and is designed in some ways to enable bioeconomic progress, is that British model of consensus bought at the price of suppressing that ambivalence, of appearing to let it happen, but in a sense not allowing the full force of that ambivalence into the public and regulatory domain?
Yeah, well, trust you, Nicholas. Get right down to business here. It was interesting at that conference because Susie Leather was like the only social scientist who spoke on the day. And it is an interesting feature of most of these science and society type workshops and all that social scientists don't have a particularly prominent role. And I think that quote is interesting because I do think it sounds like on the one hand straight out of the PR package, but on the other hand it is quite an accurate description of the history of legislation here, which has had a very unusual combination of a very, very high level of regulation and a very, very high level of public approval and approval from scientists as well. And even though it's very, very liberal. And I think that there's two problems with consensus. First of all, you know, is consensus always the best thing? I mean, there's some things about which there's consensus that, you know, like the death penalty, that we might not be very happy to want to take forward for other reasons. And secondly, if underlying an apparent consensus is a much greater degree of ambivalence than is usually detected by the usual means of investigated public consensus, which are opinion polls, then, you know, what is that? It just raises the same question. What is that consensus about? I mean, I think the Warnock strategy was interesting because it basically said we're not going to be able to make these decisions on the basis of formal ethical principles. There's never going to be an answer to the moral status of the human embryo. It has to be a practical approach that people can participate in, at least at some level. And in that sense, even though she was a philosopher, she was kind of almost being a sociologist. And I suppose to me that's the intriguing thing about the language of consensus, although I agree with you that it's very problematic and potentially misleading.
Please. Can you wait for the mic? Here in the center.
Thank you very much for that, Sarah. I wondered if I could ask you one very specific question and then one more general one. And the very specific one was about that Susie Leather quotation, because I thought it in itself it was very indicative of the new forms of engagement which assume that the engagement will give the okay to biotechnology as it's now developing. And looking closely at that quotation, what she was saying was, we need a consensus to go forward. She wasn't saying we need a consensus, or we're going to inquire to see whether or not we'll go forward. We'll get the consensus and we'll go forward. That was the implication.
Yeah.
And the second question was a larger one about precisely the relationship between that investment in a version of what Britain's ability to manage biotechnology means in a competitive world context and the kind of imperative that provides. When you were emphasizing the imperative that's coming from below in fairly traditional expectations and hopes around science and technology. So what's the relationship between that on-the-ground kind of imperative, and this big one, as Brown and other people are constantly invoking, that very special position that Britain has and how important that is economically.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think all of those questions circulate around the very distinctive profile that national culture plays in this area, because it is very striking how huge the differences are between even countries that are next to each other, like, you know, Denmark, Norway, and Finland have completely different sort of profiles on these topics. And I agree with you. You have to acknowledge that the constant emphasis on Britain's leadership and the knowledge economy and its competitive place within Europe and the importance for national economic growth, that it continues to capitalize on its unique scientific accomplishments, yada, 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 all of that is clearly a driver, and you wouldn't want to kind of pretend it isn't. But on the other hand, I mean, as you yourself have written in your work so elegantly, there is something very distinctively British about that equation between reproduction, progress, and technology that goes quite far back. I'm actually more interested in that in some ways. I'm a little bit more interested in what it is about national cultural formations, as essentialist as that concept always is, will lead to the view, the very popular view. I mean, Darwin, you know, you get so many of his ideas from pigeon fanciers here in London. There is an underlying sort of popular common sense about, I mean, to put it really crudely, about manipulating the facts of life that has a very English pedigree. That's a curious fact that has actually been much commented upon by anthropologists as well as historians. So I would be skeptical for all the reasons you say, but I also wouldn't want to let that skepticism prevent us from asking what she's referring to, in the sense that since the Warnock report was published and since the HFEA was established, there has been a huge amount of public support, a strikingly high level of public support for, you know, new, often quite radical forms of biological re-engineering of the beginnings of human life. That is, I mean, you don't want to overstate the case, but I also wouldn't want to overlook really all the different features, all the different aspects of that. Much as I agree that, you know, she's using it in a very you know, participation is good, we have people participating, therefore we're good, let's go, kind of way.
Okay, I've got a question up at the back, which I'm going to take in a second, but just earlier on, someone from the floor passed me a written question, and I'm going to ask a version of that now, because it links to the old British tradition of manipulating the facts of life, and also to something that you said, Sarah, quite close to the end of your talk. The question that's now on the agenda is, how is society going to organize its own biology? Well, a question from the gentleman on the floor that he handed to me concerns one thing that has been taken by many to be characteristic of a kind of natural form of human biology, which is the kind of rate of reproduction of the normal family, the normal lifespan, the normal move from people from reproductive age through non-reproductive age to old age and death. And so the question that the gentleman asked me from the floor was what you thought the consequences of these new reproductive technologies might be for our idea of what a normal average family might be. A man, a woman, and 2.4 children, that kind of idea that became so inbound in what one thought of as the normal domesticated nuclear family over the second half of the 20th century. what might be the wider consequences? What I take to be the question is, what might be the wider consequences for our society as a whole, the nature and characteristics and shape of our population of some of these technologies?
Well, that's quite a broad question, but I suppose what I would like to know, as reproductive technology becomes much more a part of recreating families, what reproductive effect will that have? I mean, I think Marilyn Strathairn captures that very well when she talks about the role of increasing assistance to biology having consequences on how we understand reproduction in and of itself. And then she says that itself will have an effect on how people understand their relationships to one another. And I think that will be the interesting thing to watch. Where do we see that happening? How do we see that being true? And I don't think by any means that that will be limited to the family.
Okay, I'm going to take maybe two more questions. So I'll take the one up at the top, gentleman in the white shirt, please. And
You spoke about differences in national cultures, but isn't another factor in regulation of these technologies that patients and researchers can travel to whichever country has the regulatory regime that suits them? In a sense, this is nothing new. It's been happening for decades with abortion. In the context of PGD, you mentioned the Hashmi family, but there was another case, the Whitakers, who were initially prohibited from creating a savior sibling in this country, and they went to the States and did it successfully, and perhaps that created the pressure for the change in the HFVA guidelines on that. So the fact that people can travel presumably would be a pressure to, all the things being equal, have looser regulation than would otherwise be the case. And perhaps for those who really care about regulation, maybe a case for having regulation at a broader level, like at least across the European Union, rather than having countries having separate regulations.
Well, as I mentioned, so-called reproductive tourism is another of the changes that's occurred post-IVF, although perhaps there were versions of it earlier. That's the subject of a lot of debate. You know, the Hashmi and the Whitaker decision was, I think, an example of the very difficult task the HFVA has. They have been commissioned by Parliament to fulfill the requirements of the Act, and the difference between the Hashmi and the Whitaker case was that Zain Hashmi's condition is an inherited condition. So if he underwent pre-implantation genetic selection, it would be primarily to prevent the transmission of a potentially terminal childhood genetic disease. In addition, embryo could be tissue matched, if possible, which in his case proved not to be possible because his mother has been unable to become pregnant either in the States or in Britain with that technology. The Whitakers, Black Fan anemia is a mutation, not an inherited condition. From the point of view of the HFVA, to allow the Whitakers to undergo selection only to select for, with no selection against anything, would be to set a significant new precedent in the use of PGD, not just to prevent serious disease, which is the criteria, to prevent serious disease is a criteria for being allowed to use PGD, for getting a license. The Whitakers were not using PGD to prevent serious disease. So, you know, I think from that point of view, it made a lot of sense. If you're going to have a law, the difficulty is to maintain it. But in this area, the challenge is also that it has to be changed. You know, the other thing Mary Warnock says, the one thing everyone agrees on is there have to be some limits. The problem is, as soon as the limits are set up, we see all these pressures for them to be changed. and the HFEA has to do a credible, accountable, and, you know, popular to an extent, version of maintaining the law and changing the law and communicating why. So I think they have a very difficult situation, and it certainly is, as you say, it certainly is not going to go away. It will continue to be the case that people will travel other places to get treatment.
Okay, I'm going to take the last two questions together and then allow Sarah to answer those. So yes, please, and then... Yeah, the mic.
Sarah, you provided a wonderfully eloquent deconstruction of the discursive and semiotic complications surrounding the idea of revolution, and I think you showed how extremely problematic it is as a term, but it sort of still leaves it us with us it hanging there. I was reminded while you were talking of another august LSE scholar, Anthony Giddens, who suggested that the advent of contraception and the creation of the pill could be described as the third great separation, which was equivalent in its human import to the agricultural moment in early human origins and the rise of industrialism. And both those moments did have that activity of separating out other domains that you wouldn't necessarily assume to be connected with them. For example, in industrialization, the separation of home and work. And I wondered if we followed that particular language of separation forward, whether it would open up a different line of inquiry, perhaps, or parallel line of inquiry, part of which might be to say that, as Kaya Finkler's pointed out, in the family, DNA remembers. So her point that DNA remembers, I take to mean that families don't always remember, but DNA memory is a different kind of memory, and might come even to supersede ordinary, everyday genealogical memory. Another illustration of that is Stefan Helmreich's point about transfer, that the ability to transfer cellularly is dislocating us, separating us from genealogy as a whole, and so our whole conception of kinship might possibly be altered. Now, you don't necessarily have to think of that as a revolution, but it provides new sort of combinatory ways of thinking out the problem. And I wondered if you could think whether there were other examples where that might be a productive way of conceiving the issue.
We're going to take the last two together. Okay, and we're going to take this with the very last question and then allow Sarah to come back.
Thank you, Sarah, for a wonderful talk. I would like to remind you that You are talking about the reproductive revolution, but obviously another revolution has taken place as well. When we met 20 years ago in FinRage, we met in opposition to the reproductive technologies, and it seems that today you include us in the we in the title of your talk. So I would like to ask you a question about normativity. What has brought about this normative or political change in yours and my and other feminists' view of these reproductive technologies?
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that question, and I'd like to take them in reverse order because I think that will make the most sense. And that's such an important question. I think the thing about FinRage that for me left such a lasting impression was the difference, and we used to talk about this, the difference between the association of that acronym with a position. The position, the name expressed, Feminist International Network of Resistance to Reproductive and Genetic Engineering. Whoever thought that up was giving them all a bit of a mouthful. Because I think the experience of being in FinRage, what was really interesting was even before it became more global, there was a huge gap between the name of the network, the position that was associated with of complete opposition to all forms under all circumstances, now and then the future of yada yada yada, and the reality, which was of a much more mixed picture. And I noticed this exact same tendency between the titles of many of the books that were written in that period and their contents. So Deborah Steinberg's and Pat Spillane's book, you know, Made to Order, you know, the myth of reproductive and genetic progress, says in its title a very clear denunciation of the field. But the contents don't say that at all. The contents of the book actually include many articles by feminists, particularly in third world countries, who are saying, actually, these are really important. And the big split in FinRage was between the women in the Forum Against Oppression of Women in Bombay, who passed the law in the state of Maharashtra against the use of amniocentesis, but we did not want it to exclude women who were survivors of the Bhopal disaster to be able to use amniocentesis to control their pregnancy. And so they were not in the FinRage line. And the thing about FinRage that I think is hugely still important and actually hasn't changed my view at all is that, you know, you might think it would be easy to take a simple position for or against these technologies, but it isn't. I mean, I actually don't think I've changed my view about that at all. And I, as I said, the entire title of the lecture is a familiar cliche, and we do all belong, I think, to that language. It is our language. So I am still searching, you know, for the same thing, which is really ways that enable being critical also to be engaged with everything else that these technologies involve, which quite clearly is becoming less and less, is becoming more and more complex. So if I can just turn to Nenica, thank you for that lovely question, and thank you in particular for the opportunity to explain my diagram, which I haven't really had a chance to talk about yet. But mobiology, you know, which I'm kind of naming from the Henry Moore case, which was another separation between the law and the body, they gave us most stem cells and most cell lines, I think also expresses a fundamental mobility of the biological, where there's this huge circulation now between what you might call the sociological, the technological, and the biological. And these rotations, which I've tried to indicate here, are where I think, you know, the real reproductive revolution is happening, because what we see is this, you know, turning of the meaning of one thing as it emerges out of a technological context into something quite else as it becomes biological, and then again into something quite else in a sociological frame. And I don't think you could find a more appropriate example of that than human embryonic stem cells, which, you know, really, as I say, have forced these issues into public. And I'm not sure about the language of separation. I just think those are sort of historical lines that get drawn for the purpose of, you know, laying out a terrain in retrospect. I think it's quite difficult to... There are separations, but they're so often followed quite closely by a reconnection. So that's my answer, I guess. So thank you very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, sisters and brothers, comrades and friends, I'm not quite sure what the terminology is we're supposed to use here at the LSE these days. Before I invite you all to join us for a reception up on the fifth floor, I'd just like to thank Sarah for a terrific lecture, which I think illustrates all her strengths, both the engagement with the history and traditions of the discipline, with the work of this particular institution, and a profound and sensitive involvement with the complexities which not only trouble every individual who has to confront reproductive technologies, but also trouble those who have to regulate them. And I think it's often easy to take one or the other position and to take the position of those who are regulated or to take the position of the regulators, and it's very hard to hold the two of them together. I don't know about revolutions. I don't know when the people in the French Revolution thought they were living through the French Revolution, or the people in the Industrial Revolution realized they were living through the Industrial Revolution. Well, the language of revolution is certainly all about us, but one thing that we do know is that even if there is a revolution going on, we're living in the middle, and we're living in a period of enormous ambivalence, and our scholarship in some way has to respect and engage with that ambivalence. And I think it's a mark of Sarah's scholarship that she has been able to hold on to that ambivalence and at the same time clarify it for us. So I'd like to thank Sarah for a fine inauguration of her chair at the LSE, and thank you all for your questions. Thank you.